Welcome to Conversations in World History. My name is David Sharon, and this series is a bridge to the past, connecting scholars to people interested in the deeper meaning of history. Here, I chat with historians about the past, their research, and major questions and debates in the field. This is not the story of what happened, it's the discussion of the why and the how. These episodes should help us all engage in the fascinating conversations of world history and to hear from the people who are writing the next pages. Thank you for joining. For this first episode, I'm speaking about India then and now with Ian Barrow, professor of South Asian history at Middlebury College in Vermont. He has written three books, the latest being A History of the British East India Company. Ian is currently working on a new book about the history of the independence struggles in South Asia. Well, Ian, it's really great to talk to you. We've communicated for a number of years by email, and you've always been my go-to guy about questions about Indian history, and we've never met or talked, and you always give me great, thoughtful responses. So it's really a pleasure to get a chance to talk with you. Now, I wanted to start out with a question about your writing. You've written a few books about Indian history. You've written a book on the British East India Company in India, a book on Sri Lanka. And now you're planning to write a book, if I remember, a kind of general history of India. And I was wondering, why is there a need for a new history of India? I'm sure that there have been other histories, general histories written so far. So what's going to be new about this one?
Oh, well, you're quite right. It's a topic that's been much covered, but I think that there is a need and an interest in having a very short textbook on the run-up to independence in 1947. There are a lot of in-depth books on the independence movement and also on the partitioning of India, and some of them I admire greatly. But I think that there is still a niche out there for a short textbook that's going to be attractive to high school students, in particular to college students who are studying India as part of a broader examination of world history, for instance.
Well, it's certainly a topic that deserves attention. It's an area where we spend a lot of our time in my high school history classes. It is, of course, the part of the history that involves Gandhi and the Indian National Congress. And so it's great that there will be a focused book on that part of the history. I wanted to start off talking about, I guess, a term, India, South Asia. You're a professor of South Asian history. What exactly is South Asia? What is India? Do those mean the same thing? Are they interchangeable? Do the meaning of each of those terms change over time? Does South Asia mean something different in the past? Does India mean something different in the past?
Those are very interesting and actually potentially quite political questions that you're asking. Generally speaking, I think in academia, we think of South Asia as the area that encompasses what is today Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and a few other countries as well, perhaps even going into Afghanistan, perhaps moving into Myanmar, which was called Burma. But nevertheless, that region is often referred to as South Asia. It can be called India, but because countries, nation states today exist that are not India itself, we tend to label the region South Asia rather than just India. Sometimes pre-partition South Asia has been called India. That is a designation that I tend to move away from simply because it tends to enter into political territory of what legacies exist from the past.
I want to ask you a question about the colonial period. So the basic story, as I and I think a lot of people know it, is that the British came in, there was a battle of Plassey, and the British win, the British East India Company takes control. Then there's a sepoy uprising in the mid-19th century. It's over one of the issues being the use of pork and beef fat and the rifles, which people find very interesting. After that, the British Raj takes over. They control the territory until the independence movement, Gandhi, etc., and India gains independence in 1947. And then, of course, there's a partition where Pakistan as well gains independence and to two separate countries. But then in the meantime, during this story, there's something called the princely states, which I've never understood. What are these princely states and how do they help us understand the extent to which the British had complete control in the colony and that the Indian people maybe had some sort of autonomy?
That's a very interesting and important question that you ask. So when the East India Company, the British East India Company, began to expand its territory in the mid-18th century, so in the 1750s in particular, 1760s, it began to expand its territories in South Asia. And as a result, it decided at certain moments after it was able to conquer certain territory to either keep a puppet ruler in place or to absorb the territory directly into its expanding state. And it would do so for different reasons over time, but over the course of about 100 years from the 1750s right through to the 1840s, we find that the East India Company decides to keep roughly about two-thirds of the territory that it conquers and keep aside a third of the territory to be ruled by these puppet or intermediary rulers who were South Asian, but would nevertheless be controlled behind the scenes by the British. And so the term that came to be used for these other territories were the princely states.
So would we say then that they had some autonomy or even that they had more autonomy than the people who were living directly under the British Raj, the British colonial government?
Well, that depends as the years go by. So in according to the treaties that existed between the East India Company and later the Raj and these princely states, internal matters were governed by the princes themselves. Any external matters such as warfare or trade outside or negotiations between states had to go through the British. There was an ambassador who was located in the most important of these states, whose name was a resident, and the resident would control the communications between the princes and the outside world.
Hmm. Here's a question about colonialism. So there are a few different lenses we could use to try to understand power in colonialism. On the one hand, we can try to emphasize the injustices of the colonial system, which I think is really important, the cruelties, the mistreatment, and to, as a teacher, for example, have students grapple with and understand those injustices. On the other hand, we can also use a lens trying to understand the agency of the colonized people, the Indians in this case. What power did they maintain? to try to show that nobody is ever powerless, and they were not powerless, and that they made choices, they made decisions, and they used their power in different ways to try to navigate the colonial system. Which of those lenses do you think is more important to emphasize, if one is?
I think they're complementary. So I think you can do both at the same time. I think on the one hand, I think it is important to demonstrate and show how a colonial state was extractive, the ways in which it was able to manipulate and control individuals, the ways in which it benefited a foreign country, the ways in which it used force to exert its authority. So I think these are important themes to stress. But on the other hand, I think it's also equally important to note that power wasn't altogether effective, that there were ways in which the weaker power held by indigenous populations was strengthened, perhaps by in a variety of different ways that are very interesting to study, and in the end resulted in independence for these states and the overthrow of a colonial state. So I think that those two approaches that you mentioned are very complementary and important in any study of a colonial state.
Can you give me one example of one of those colonial injustices, of ways in which the British extracted or abused their power? And also, could you give me an example of Indian agency? There's obviously the famous Gandhi stories, perhaps beyond that, but ways in which Indians used their power and choices and agency to navigate the situation and improve their own conditions.
Well, I think that there are quite a variety of different ways in which the British were able to exert authority over Indians. I think you can look at brute force, for instance. There was a massacre that took place in the early part of the 20th century in North India that resulted in a great deal of discussion about the role of the British as imperial masters of South Asia, and the ways in which that galvanized the independence movement. You could look at the ways in which trade relations between South Asia and the British state were manipulated to the advantage of the British. You could look at the ways in which India was placed on a silver standard, and how that in the late 1800s, early 1900s was detrimental to trade, for instance. So there were quite a variety of different arenas that you could examine. In terms of the ways in which South Asians were able to fight against the British, I think that, even though you mentioned Gandhi, I think that actually Gandhi is a very interesting individual, precisely because he decolonizes himself in ways that were stunningly successful. And perhaps the most visible way was that he decided very early on not to wear European clothing, in a show that attracted other South Asians into the political arena.
So I think the typical story of independence is that Gandhi is essentially responsible. His work is the cause of independence. Some of this comes from the movie Gandhi, but the kind of traditional narrative is that he engages in a whole number of methods of resistance, ranging from the Salt March to boycotts to fasting, and eventually his soul force is what leads the British to become so fed up with his protests that they decide to quit India, to leave India. And so India gets independence in 1947. Is this the full story of Indian independence? Is this a nuanced enough story to understand what happened?
Well, I think that's a beginning to understanding independence. I think that most historians would agree that Gandhi, although an important figure in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s in India was nevertheless only one of many individuals, and that in many ways his activities were not as successful as the myth about Gandhi has propagated, that he had many failures, and that historians have had a mixed response to how to evaluate his contributions to not just the independence of India, but also the what happens to India after independence. So I think it's a much more complex, nuanced story. And of course, you have to throw in the fact that there was a rival, a very important rival nationalist movement known as the Muslim League, that was advocating, especially in the 1940s, for the creation of a homeland for Muslims that was to be called Pakistan.
While we're talking about historical debate here, if Gandhi is not necessarily the sole cause of Indian independence, and we're looking for other causes for why, after decades of struggle, India gains independence in 1947, is World War II then one of the other major immediate causes of Indian independence that we need to consider? Is that something historians look at?
Yes, certainly. I think the Second World War was a precipitating factor. So if you asked individuals in 1938 whether in India would become independent and whether there would be a Pakistan in 1947, I think incredulity would be, you'd be met but with incredulity. So the Second World War has a very interesting effect. It accelerates the march towards independence by, for instance, pushing the British into a position where they had to begin to make concessions, political concessions, during the war itself. And after the war, we find that the British are no longer in a financial position, perhaps, to maintain an empire. There's a change of government in Britain. The Labour Party becomes dominant, and there is a decision made to leave India. So I think the Second World War certainly has a major factor. I think that the rise of the movement for Pakistan is another factor in its success. I think that also parties and other individuals were also responsible for pushing the success of independence.
Let's talk a bit about post-independence India. A lot of us know the story of Gandhi and Indian independence, but what should everybody know about India between 1947 and today? What's most important?
Well, gosh, so I think one of the big stories to concentrate on is the dominance of the Congress Party, which is the party that led to independence, the main political party that led to independence. Gandhi was part of the Congress Party, and his great friend and protege, Jawaharlal Nehru, becomes the prime minister. And the Congress Party for many decades is the dominant party in India, but it is no longer the dominant party in India. So how and why is that the case? Why is it that regional parties become important? Why is that the caste parties rise in the conversation? And especially, why is it that Hindu nationalist parties, especially what is known as the BJP, which is the current political party in power, how do they gain a voice and some authority in India? So I think that would be, if I were to pinpoint one major change, it would be that. Another major change is how does India move from being a very poor country, an impoverished country in 1947, to being actually in many regards, quite a rich country today? And what is that story? How is it able to feed itself? How is it able to generate a middle class? How is it able to have a space program, have a very robust military, for instance? How is it able to educate such vast numbers of individuals. So this is, I think, a very interesting story to tell as well.
One of the reasons to study the past is to try to understand the present. So if we're attempting to grasp India today and try to understand it in all of its complexities, is it more important for us to spend time digging into colonial India? Or would we be better off looking at India's past 50 years to try to understand some of the issues it faces today?
Oh, that is a very interesting question. I think in some ways that's going to be, the answer to that is going to be based a little bit on your own politics, your own position vis-a-vis India, and your age perhaps as well. I think the older you are, the more inclined you are to think that the colonial state still has a vestigial hold on today. I think the younger you are, you may think of the colonial period as really more of a historical incident rather than something that continues to have sway over the politics and the society of today. So I think in some ways, your answer is going to change depending on who you ask and whether they're Indian or whether they're not Indian. My own view as a historian is that there are some interesting legacies of colonialism, but that as fewer and fewer people today were alive during the colonial period, I think it's going to be inevitable that we will begin to think of that period more and more as the past and rather than a component of the present.
In other words, in a few decades, it's possible that colonial history for India is just a blip on the radar of its thousands of years of civilization and history, and no longer has the same resonance as it might today. What are some of the big questions of historical debate about India and its modern history?
Well, I think that I think that there are different kinds of debates happening. There are debates in India specifically, and there are debates outside of India. I think that in India, there's a lot of debate about the role of what we might call the sort of the Hindu imaginary, the ways in which Hinduism has played a role in the past and how Hindu civilization continues to assert a dominant role in South Asia. So I think that that's been a legacy of the rise of Hindu nationalist parties, especially the BJP. So I think that is certainly a debate that's happening in India. I think that outside of India, there is indeed, as you suggest, with your point towards broader analyses, I think there's a very interesting there are interesting approaches to how to incorporate India into broader narratives, and I think an exciting way in which history is developing with regards to South Asia is to not look so much at 1947 as a dividing point, but to see continuities between the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and to begin to write and study history that isn't simply pre-1947 and post-1947.
Can you give me one example of a continuity that might be looked at there?
Yeah, so I think that the army and the state itself demonstrate awkward continuities. So that the British Indian Army becomes the Indian Indian Army and the Pakistani Army in 1947, and they retain many of the traditions that existed before, and so that colonial legacy lasts well many decades after 1947. And I think in many ways the state itself, how it's organized, how it everything from the calendar to the various departments that are set up to the civil service itself, These are all modeled on the colonial state, and those don't begin to get dismantled, even if they do, until well after 1947.
A last question for you, Ian. What are two books that you wish everybody read about South Asian history?
Well, I think since we've discussed independence quite a bit today, I think that my favorite book is by a professor called Yasmin Khan, who wrote a book called The Great Partition.
It's incredible.
Came out, I think, quite a while ago, 2008, although it seems very fresh even today. I think it's a wonderful book, very accessible.
Yeah.
And so I'd definitely recommend that. The other book that I would recommend actually is not on India, it's on Pakistan, and it came out fairly recently. It came out in 2020. It's by a man called Declan Walsh, who is a journalist, and it's called Dispatches from a Precarious State, The Nine Lives of Pakistan. And it's, I think, a very interesting and approachable book that examines the history of Pakistan through nine individuals. I'd recommend that.
Sounds fantastic. Well, Ian, thank you so much for speaking with me. I wish you the best of luck on your semester and, of course, on the book that you're working on.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure.
My pleasure as well. Bye-bye.
Thank you to my guest and also to Colin McGrath for the beautiful music. Check out Colin's album Window Seat and his new songs on Spotify or wherever you get your music. And if you're interested in learning about my books on teaching social studies, my upcoming picture books, or a variety of teaching resources, take a look at my website, davidsharon.net. Hope you join me here again.